Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at SchoolSucksShow. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username SchoolSucksPodcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
I hate the self-helpy stuff around goal setting, where there'll be all these ridiculous goal setting workshops the self-help gurus will run for people. And more often than not, my issue was, even though I always did very, very well at school, I think because I was very highly schooled by the time I was, 18 years old, is I didn't know what my goals were. So it's like,
you always had a roadmap in front of you.
Yeah, which was school, was, get good grades, get to the next level, get to set the major, graduate from college, go to graduate school, do all these things.
All milestones were laid out.
It's hardly even a map. It's more like tracks.
Yeah, a track that someone gave me. Yeah, in my case, specifically, the path I was on or was set to be on was a path given to me by the Institute for Humane Studies in order to become a philosophy professor,
right,
which is great. And they're a great organization, and that was incredibly helpful if that was the path I wanted to pursue. But I'd come back to all these self-helpy, goal-setting workshops, and more often than not, I run into people who they didn't know what their goals actually were. So how can you set an effective goal if you don't know what it should be?
Let's solve that problem.
Okay. I was alone. I decided to get up. Decided to get out. I picked up the phone and I gave my voice out. Thought I'd be out around nine. No particular plan. Just whatever comes to mind. Hey, everybody. This is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. Today is Monday, April 24th. A beautiful Monday. I am so fortunate to be sitting outside right now, listening to the birds sing and watching a squirrel staring at me kind of nervously. And I'm really excited to present the shows that are coming this week. Zach Slabeck returns to School Sucks Podcast. You might remember Zach from a show we did in 2016 called Building a Better Credential Than the College Degree. Zach has since left Praxis. He's gone out on his own. You can check out his website, zachslabeck.com. He does consulting and coaching for young professionals and entrepreneurs, as well as some business coaching. A very impressive young man, just 24 years old, back today to talk about goal setting. And we're going to do this in two parts. Today's discussion focuses on the importance of deschooling, getting rid of certain limiting beliefs that can interfere with meaningful personal and professional goals. And in the second installment, we will talk about Zach's ambition mapping process. If you want to jump ahead, there's a link in the show notes, zachslabeck.com, to the ambition mapping page. Since most of that isn't coming to the second part, and you're, ambitious. These shows were recorded April 9th in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I asked my good friend Andrew to join us. We actually recorded this in Andrew's studio. He also has a podcast. I don't want to tarnish Zach's personal brand by mentioning it here, but you can go to patg.com if you want to learn more about what he does. But only do that if you're ready to have a good time, okay? Bang. Anyway, as many of you know, in our bonus content section, we've been exploring these topics in great detail over the last couple months. I was really, really happy to have his input in both parts. I thought he asked some really good questions, and I really appreciate Zach coming back on the show to share so much of what he has learned with my audience. So again, today we focus on deschooling. The next show will come out on Thursday. I realize Friday is not the best day to release a podcast. And also at some point during the week, most likely on Wednesday, I'll put up a collection of outtakes for supporters of the show only. Speaking of that, if you want to incentivize more quality productions and also access a lot of additional content, please support us on Patreon. You can go to patreon.com/schoolsucks. I asked for a pledge of $1 per content item. We're very close to reaching another milestone. We reached it temporarily and then fell beneath it, and now we're trying to reach it again. And once that milestone is reached, which I'm sure it will be mid-May, we're going to launch a weekly subscriber-only show that I'm really excited about. It will probably happen after I return from New Orleans. Why are you going to New Orleans, Brett? Well, I'll tell you about that too. May 11th through the 13th, Renegade University and School Sucks Project present A Weekend with Thaddeus Russell.
There's still plenty of tickets left. You can go to ThaddeusRussell.com/courses to get more information or to purchase your tickets, and we look forward to seeing you there. So let's get right into today's show. We'll start with some updates on Zach. We'll move into our conversation about deschooling. And when we pick this up later in the week, we will talk in great detail about Zach's ambition mapping process and how you can use it, regardless of your age, to set and move towards meaningful and fulfilling goals in your professional and personal life. What a week! So part one of our marathon conversation with Zach Slabeck is about to begin. But first, ladies and gentlemen, Pittsburgh's own Donny Iris performing the best song by somebody from Pittsburgh that I know about. Here we go.
Zach Slabeck, welcome back to School Sucks.
Brett, thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. You know, the episode of the show that you were on back in 2016, it was called Building a Better Credential Than a College Degree, is probably one of the most internally linked to episodes on SchoolSucksProject.com. I link to it anytime there's a show about college, anytime there's a show about entrepreneurship, working for yourself, that show is linked in the show notes.
Oh, I'm excited to hear that. I remember I was recording that in Atlanta because I was living in Charleston at the time, and everybody thought Charleston would fall into the ocean because of a hurricane going through.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the thing why that's scarred into my memory.
Right, so. Right. But now you're in Pittsburgh.
I'm in Pittsburgh, the jewel of the Rust Belt, the Paris of Appalachia, the city of champions.
We are also joined by my dear friend Andrew. Welcome to the show, Andrew.
I'm also in Pittsburgh, and I can attest, I was just in Charleston 2 weeks ago today, and it's still there.
It is still there,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, it's surprisingly not awful, too. At least as a tourist who was there for one night.
Great. It's great as a tourist.
And got some barbecue.
Fantastic barbecue. So when I was there, we had an office at one point that was next to both a Texas barbecue restaurant and a South Carolina barbecue restaurant. I gained like 30 pounds.
Yeah, I think the longer you're there, the more you look like Jackie Gleason, too.
food-wise, it was hard to beat. Pittsburgh likes to say it's a food city, but...
No, it's just French fries on salad.
Yeah, and then like hipster $20 hamburgers downtown.
Yeah, I've been away for 9 years from Pittsburgh, and I have never seen more. I mean, there's a mix of hipster and then local old-fashioned Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of hipster happening here.
There is.
I was not prepared for it at all.
The whole Lawrenceville area, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Is just entirely hipster.
That's why I decided to live in the ghetto. I said, where are the most murders? Put me within a mile.
I mean, Crofton, I don't know. This neighborhood, I kind of think it's where everyone's aunt lives. Like, no one lives here, but their aunts all live here.
Yeah, my whole life, the South Hills of Pittsburgh, the southern area of the city, it was just where my grandparents lived, and that was it.
There's, have either of you guys seen the judgmental map of Pittsburgh? I asked you this the other night, Brett.
I made one of these ones.
Okay,
have you seen the original? Where to live. I have not. I didn't know there was one.
Okay, so there's actually a website called Judgmental Maps, and I think the Pittsburgh one was made in like 2010, so it's a little outdated. Pittsburgh's a lot nicer since then.
I'm going to make a note of this.
And where I live now was labeled heroin, hobos, and hookers, I think. So I live on the north side in a neighborhood called the Mexican War Streets, which when I was a kid, I thought meant that there were like Mexican gangs there, but it means Mexican-American War.
Right.
And then I lived in Greentree for a while, which was labeled Ron Paul used to live here a very long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
So when I met Ron Paul, we talked about Greentree and how he was a milkman in Pittsburgh. So the most wholesome figure you can imagine of Ron Paul when he's like 18 years old is delivering milk to everyone's great grandma's house.
So we're on the outskirts of Pittsburgh right now. We're actually at Andrew's house in Andrew's studio, and there are some good reasons why I wanted him to join us on the show today, and we'll get to that in a bit. I wanted some updates since it's been...
Yeah.
We did work together in 2017. I teamed up with you and Jeff Till to...
Yeah, the De-School Yourself podcast.
The De-School Yourself. The brief, what was there, six or seven?
Yeah, six or seven episodes. Jeff, you know, produced all of those, but that's still available online. It's a fantastic little series. You know, you joined us, TK Coleman, Peter Gray, Thaddeus Russell. It was a ton of fun.
Yeah, so... that was the last time we talked in front of microphones. I'm super excited to have you back on the show. I hope everybody checks out our first conversation because it's one of my favorite episodes of School Sucks podcast. I mean, the only thing that
you know, is really wrong here is, like, we do expect when a guest comes to bring, like, a sliceable in-season fruit.
Oh, too bad. I've got a pineapple sitting at my house because someone just brought it to a party I had. Huh.
I brought a pineapple to his house. And
is it in season?
It's spring.
I invited, we do like a quarterly party at my house, and Brett, I invited him. I told people, you know, bring a snack or we'll have, you know, some cocktails and beer. And most people, they bring chips, or there's this one kid from Carnegie Mellon who every time he comes brings the same chocolate cake bought from Giant Eagle, the same cake every single time. And Brett walks in, he pulls out his seltzer, and he pulls out a pineapple. And I'm just like, I don't even know how to cut that.
Yeah, now you have homework. You have a chore. Like, you have to Google how to cut a pineapple. Who knows how to operate a pineapple?
No. There was a thing with the instructions
on it. Yeah, so I was about to throw it away thinking it was a sticker you bought at Giant Eagle to celebrate Pittsburgh or something. Like a Yinzer sticker or something. And it's the pineapple... I guess it's not a manufacturer, but like the seller understands that no one knows how to cut a pineapple. So they include a little sticker that has instructions on how to actually cut the pineapple on it.
You know, I also brought cashews and some rice.
All right, that's a little better. Right. Now,
it's not like I just showed up like with a pineapple, like a lunatic, right? It was one of a few things.
Okay, well, I feel less bad on your behalf now. However, I wouldn't put that past you because one time you and I were going to a party. I don't know where we were going. I forget whose party it was. But you insisted that we stop at the grocery store at the busiest time of day in New Hampshire, and we had to track down a pineapple.
No.
We specifically went to a store for no other reason than to get a pineapple.
I think you've just been in New Hampshire too long, and you're thinking in terms of porcupines. And what's the fruit that's most like a porcupine? I will buy that and take that to people.
I don't know. I find it to be a fairly exotic thing that feeds several people.
It's snowing in April in Pittsburgh. No one is thinking in terms of pineapples.
No. Not that it's snowing today. Today is not a pineapple day. Friday night, or Saturday night?
Saturday
was it?
Night.
That day had pineapple written all over it.
I'll have to
it.
Go back on my calendar and mark that and study it and understand why it was a pineapple.
How
day.
Many people at this party?
I don't know. We probably had like 20 to 30 people.
20 to 30
Everyone
people.
Gets a slice.
How many partook in the pineapple?
I don't know. Nobody. Because,
exactly.
Yes, because the one cutting board I had was being used as a charcuterie board. So it's like, I'm not going to clean that off and then cut the pineapple.
Right.
We're for like the four
here.
People
we're
who
not,
use it.
We're not on a Hawaiian vacation. If there's cake and there's charcuterie and a pineapple, what are you going to go for?
Cake and charcuterie.
Yeah, right. who's going to voluntarily get themselves all sticky? And again, what do you do with it? Everyone's got to read instructions? There's no instructions for cake.
Yeah.
Brett did make a compelling case that it would make a great centerpiece for like 4 days.
So. Right. That it's purely decorative.
Yes. So
you brought the garnish to the party.
Well, yeah. So I had to cram an awkward pineapple joke into this show because we were supposed to do this at your house. And I was going to say, here we are. Here. Two men on either side of a pineapple.
Well, then I saw your beautiful studio photo. So I volunteered to come up here. Get me out of the house, too.
Well, yeah. Thanks for I'm a guest here for the weekend. Andrew, thanks for having us.
Thanks for having it here. It made it really easy for me.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Zach, let's talk about what you've been doing since the first time you were a guest on School Sucks in 2016. At the time, you were part of the founding team of Praxis. You were the director of business development.
Yeah, I helped Praxis find new companies at which to place their participants.
Okay. What have you done since? When did you leave? And how have you, because I know the work you were doing at Praxis was kind of a springboard into what you're doing now. So I'd like to hear all about
that. Yeah, so I left Praxis in March of 2017, so about a year ago, a little bit more than a year ago. And in the time in between, I did a little bit of consulting, a little bit of freelance writing, worked with some organizations and companies out in the San Francisco Bay Area more than anything else. Started writing this book that I was going to self-publish, you know, flew to Argentina for a couple of weeks. I was like, I'll pull a Tim Ferriss. I'll go disappear in Argentina and write a book, which was actually very conducive to writing a book because I don't speak a lick of Spanish. So it was like, oh, the only things I can do is sit in this apartment, drink wine and eat steak and write. So that was actually pretty good productivity system. If you ever need to get a lot done, go to a country that you don't speak the language and hole yourself up in an apartment.
See, I had the same thing happen to me, except for I didn't go there for any ambitious self-development project or professional project.
What was the country?
Costa Rica.
Okay.
For a couple of months. And I had no plan, though, and I got real bored real fast. And all I did was surf watch Spanish television, usually Chinese movies with Spanish subtitles.
That's odd.
Yeah, that wasn't helpful.
Weird.
I definitely watched Kung Fu Hustle. I watched the Shaolin soccer movie. Yep. It's all visually entertaining, but I have no idea what actually happened. But I did get a lot of reading done. I should have had a better plan to be more productive, though.
My plan was to be less productive, but then because I had friends who told me, oh, you know, Buenos Aires, it's a major metropolitan center. You'll get by with knowing minimal Spanish. No, you need to know Spanish to get around Buenos Aires. Mm-hmm. I learned that the hard way. So it was unintentionally very productive. But I've been focusing a lot of my attention on really understanding what makes people successful in their careers, especially early on in their careers, and especially falling outside of this traditional kind of pipeline where you go to college, then you go get a very established kind of job with a very established kind of hierarchy. You put in a couple years and you get promoted, a couple more years, you get promoted, you go get the MBA, you come back, a couple more years, get promoted. And that's looked like a couple of things for a lot of my work. I've been writing a lot. A literary agent actually approached me in the fall, said, hey, I saw you wrote this book, The End of School. Would you like to sell it to an established publisher? I said no, but she convinced me to sell this new one to an established publisher. So that was one thing. I've been working with a venture capital fund out in the San Francisco Bay Area, helping them with some content, education, and marketing. And then I do some one-on-one coaching with people.
Right.
So
you came on the scene with this book, The End of School, pretty much. Is that fair to say?
I don't know if you'd say I came on the scene. I was surprised by how positively received that book was.
And what year was it published?
2016. Yep. May of 2016, almost 2 years ago. It was a compilation of blog posts, actually. I was working at Praxis in 2015, and I was talking to Isaac Morehouse one day, and I said, you know, I'd really like to write. And, you know, this is something that I see myself doing. And he's, well write.
Mm-hmm.
That's it? He's like, yeah, just write. So I decided to write once a day for 30 days. And then I kept doing it for like 80 days. And when I was done, I looked back, I was almost entirely writing on education. I'd read a ton of books on education in that period because whatever I'm reading at the time is usually what I end up writing about. And a lot of those blog posts got a lot of traction. So The End of School is actually just a collection of blog posts and essays, mm-hmm. right? Which was one of the reasons why I didn't want to sell to an established publisher. But at the same time, I was really pleasantly surprised by how much traction that book got.
So I bring it up because as somebody who is coaching young people and even people, you know, I mean, you're what, 24?
Yeah.
I'm 40. You're 31, right? So we're all in different places. It was very cool. Last week on my show, I went out to Philly and I met this 18-year-old kid named Matt.
Yeah.
And he taught my whole audience, almost entirely composed of people older than he is, about, you know, quantum health and blue light and the history of Eastern Europe.
Huh.
So it's nice to have, you know, another person considerably younger than me here in a teaching role. You know, but you work mostly with people who are younger than you.
It's a good mix. A lot of my one-on-one coaching is actually people a little bit older than me.
Mm-hmm.
It's people maybe like 24 to 35. The people who I work less one-on-one with, but as readers in my audience or people who will send me emails that I'll do a little bit of back and forth with,
Yeah. They
do tend to be a little bit younger than me.
Right. So I think what's really important when you're doing this kind of career coaching or entrepreneurial coaching, you know how to look forward, but you also, from the starting point of the end of school, you know how to look back. You understand what the hindrances are. And this is kind of like how you and I first came together on this issue of school. I think all three of us have similar attitudes about, you know, the public school that we endured and probably about higher education too.
Yeah.
I, being the oldest, didn't know there were other options once I was there. So I stuck it out until I earned a bachelor's degree and then I went back and earned a certificate and then didn't realize I could just drop out and do something else until I was like 16 credits shy of a master's. Andrew, you never went to school.
For as similar as we feel on school, I had the complete opposite experience. I never considered school an option for me.
Hmm.
Right. Exactly. And you dropped out of the University of Pennsylvania?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I was talking with an acquaintance of mine this morning, a lawyer here in town who doesn't particularly like being a lawyer, which is descriptive of almost every single lawyer I've ever met.
Right. And many people that I met, that was a big portion of the conversation I was having at your party the other night, is people like, you know, they get into this and they just start resenting the work, and they're handcuffed to
it. Now, a lot of my clients, the ones I work one-on-one with, are people who they might be working a couple of years in one of these established jobs that they were expected to go work at a major corporation, usually like a law firm or like Bayer or Heinz or a big company like that. But they actually want to run a business because they want to own their time. They want to own their own path. They don't want to sit in a cubicle all day, right? Mm-hmm. I always encourage them to watch Office Space. And it's like, if Office Space does not click with you, then you're probably not going to get along with me.
Right.
Well, I think this kind of highlights the difference between sort of the modern ambitious employee or self-driven worker or whatever it might be, or entrepreneur, versus the traditional, you know, getting employed, sticking with the same company for decades.
Well, even the guy I was talking to earlier this morning, he was saying he hates his job. He truly hates his job. And he knows he should quit, but so much of it is that he's expected to get a prestigious job and stay in that prestigious job. And I told him, well, you know, you've got all these skills. You've got numerous people actually saying that they will employ you at least part-time to apply your legal skills. Why don't you take this portfolio approach that I have and that a lot of my clients have, that I encourage people to develop, where, yes, you might have one core business that makes up a lot of your income, but then you also might have consulting on the side, or you might sell a specific kind of product next to that, or you might work with a friend in a partnership. And for him, he just sat back and he's like, I think that the people in the generation older than us, say like the baby boomers is what he was really referencing, they would be so confused as to whether or not I'm self-employed or unemployed.
Right.
I mean, yeah, exactly. With my mom's family, that's how it happens all the time. They're all like your archetypal boomers, right? Where they went and they got prestigious jobs at one company, one institution, one corporation for their entire careers and then retired. And when I have to try to explain to them what I do, it totally goes over their heads.
I would get yelled at family gatherings.
I did get yelled at.
Not by my own parents, but by an ornery uncle.
Yeah.
He would, you need to have a boss, you know?
Yeah.
What are you doing without a boss?
Yep.
You know, you're not running a business because there was no, like, I'm the guy who owns this barbershop, or I'm the guy who owns
you had
this
no storefront.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
It was not no brick and mortar.
Well, I even struggle. I don't work for myself in the, you know, purely, I guess, physical sense. I work for a company, but I'm a contractor, and I cannot explain to my family, my grandparents, for example, I cannot explain to them what I do. It's impossible.
Right.
Oh, yeah. No, I remember when I wanted to leave Penn, I got this like 10 paragraph, very upset. I wouldn't call it nasty, but it was a very upset email from one of my aunts, who is, of course, a professor at like the University of Minnesota, who still is very confused by what I do. And to be honest, if I had to easily explain what I do to people, it takes a while at times.
Right.
I tell them I help people build businesses and build great careers, right?
Yeah. Your former, I guess he's still your colleague, Derek McGill, was saying that there was almost an intervention, you know, when he wanted to leave school.
Oh, yeah. Usually there's something like that where people thought, for me personally, my dad was skeptical but supportive. And I actually, as I've, you know, psychoanalyzed myself a little bit more in the past couple of years, I've thought, you know, he was an airline pilot, is an airline pilot, very much a career where it's all based on seniority, big, massive bureaucratic corporation, right? And seeing him go through that is one of the things that made me convinced, like, I am going to employ myself.
Yeah.
I don't want to have to be entirely dependent on a seniority kind of ranking or economic business cycles.
What was the process? I know we're kind of tangenting here, but what was the process or him getting more understanding of what you're doing? Because I had like a similar experience where, I talked to my dad last week. I've been doing what I'm doing for almost 9 years.
Yeah.
And my dad just got on Facebook, right? He's 69. He just got on Facebook. And he said, we're just talking on the phone. He goes, you know, by the way, your life looks really cool and interesting. I'm like, yeah, I've been trying to tell
you
guys this.
There's a reason I've been doing it this way.
Right. But what was that? What was that like as far as, you know, acceptance or understanding coming from?
Yeah, my dad was, I wouldn't quite say supportive, but, you know, I started. Yeah, I to a certain extent, I admire Derek for, he essentially just said, like, screw this and just left.
Yeah.
Like, I was a bit more conservative. I took a leave of absence first, went and worked full time with Isaac building out the company. And then after that year, I just decided, why would I go back? I'm earning more than I would have otherwise earned. I'm happier. I'm learning more. I'm meeting interesting people. I'm growing my network like crazy. And that's kind of how I pitched it to my parents, was like, look, at first, it's just going to be a leave of absence, and then I'll make the decision from there. So it's kind of like slide them into it. My dad, I wouldn't quite say he was supportive, but pretty much stepped back and said, you're smart. I know you're not going to mess up. You'll make decent decisions. Go for it. My mom, on the other hand, was very upset. Mm-hmm. but at the same time, too, I was largely supporting myself through school. So there wasn't this financial overhead where it was like, oh, well, they own me.
Right, exactly. So one of the reasons why I wanted to go into detail on this is because, you know, a big feature I think that you're discussing on your website is this concept of de-schooling. Mm-hmm. This is something that I find a lot of adults still need to do.
Yeah.
I still feel like there's schooled parts of my mindset or my outlook, my attitude towards money. I still like get sucked into a bit of like a scarcity mindset, a trade time for money kind of mindset. I'm trying to live really consciously about the ways that school influenced me and still affect me, you know, 20 plus years after I graduated from high school. And I mean, college was no better.
Yeah.
And college was actually probably a reinforcement of a lot of these bad thinking habits. Andrew, your story is interesting. You were de-schooling yourself while you were in school. He invented his own way of going. Can you tell that story?
that was a joke that we turned into a bit. But
you didn't really do that?
No, I did do it.
Okay, yeah.
But
yeah.
Only kind of as a I did nothing. Nothing I did was ever for any real reason other than for shits and giggles.
Right.
Right. So we invented this thing called afternoon school. When I say we, my close friends and I, we all did everything together. Afternoon school was dealing with the horribleness of school, and part of that was getting up early. You know, we were up late playing video games or driving around too fast or whatever it was, and it was always a chore to get up early enough and get to school on time. So we'd be late over and over and over, and we'd get punished and detention and all that. So to deal with it, we decided to think outside the box. So we decided to invent this thing called afternoon school, which is where you get home from school, you immediately go to sleep, like 3 p.m., 4 p.m., go to sleep. Get up 11 or so at night. As far as you're concerned, it's 6:30 in the morning. Take as much time as you want to yourself, stretch out, you know, relax, play some video games, watch the news, or drink, whatever you wanted to do. And then by the time school rolled around, you just had lunch. I mean, when are you more with it than in the afternoon? Like, normally,
I thought you were going to say like, oh, we would do like some sort of school in the afternoon. It's rather like you conditioned your body to believe that when you were going to school was the afternoon.
Right. We tried to move school, but it was an immovable force.
Yes.
So we moved the world around it. And think about it. You get home from school and what do you want to do? You want to go out and play. You want to go out and do an activity, sports, go hang out with your friends, do whatever. You have all these ambitions and energies when you get home from school. Well, if you want to do better at school, which really wasn't our goal, it wasn't mine at least, what better time to do it than your internal clock's afternoon?
There you go.
Hey, that's one way of approaching
it. I love that story. I just completely submitted. I know we talked about this on the show before, but for the sake of review, were you wise to this? I know you said there was like a transition for you around middle school where you realized you had to start taking things more seriously.
I mean, a big reality of my relationship with school as well that, you know, is somewhat personal, so I don't tend to go into it so much, is my parents went through a long and psychologically brutal divorce when I was growing up. A good chunk of my childhood was some function of that. Mm-hmm. And for me, I realized with school, it was like, okay, yes, this is not really what I would prefer to be doing. I learned more from playing Civilization 4 and SimCity and poking around Wikipedia than I learned in most of my classes. But if I learn to play this game, I can at least get out of here.
Yeah.
And, you know, I can play it well and benefits will come my way, which is part of the structure of school, is you want to set up the incentive structure in such a way that people will do what you want them to do. So designers of schools give people who study and spend time at school approbation. They give them pats on the head. They give them scholarships. They give them all these promises of wealth and all these promises of success and of attention and of significance and all these things like that. So the school system is also designed to indulge, you know, these desires in somebody. So it was a combination for me. It was like, okay, look, if I play this game and I play it well, and it turns out I'm actually pretty good at it, I can get through and it will allow me to control more of my life than is being controlled at home. So this is my locus of control.
Right.
And I'll get out of, you know, the town I grew up in. I'll get out of where I am and we'll figure it out from there. Mm-hmm. Right. So, but even then, you know, most of my enjoyment I got out of school came from my extracurricular activities. It came out when I turned like 14, 15, I started interning, and because of legal reasons, I actually wasn't able to do all that much with a law clerk who was at the local federal judge's courtroom. Mm-hmm. And I learned a lot more through things like that than I learned actually sitting in the classroom.
Yeah, absolutely. For me, school was never anywhere to get an education as far as I was concerned. For the first few years of my life, I was as dedicated as I needed to be to get good grades. But at a certain point, you said your turning point was middle school, where you started taking it more seriously.
Well,
you started manipulating it to your needs.
Yes, exactly.
Right. See, I saw it as something that was purely wasting time for me. I didn't see any incentives to me doing well in school. At a certain point, I woke up and I realized getting straight A's gets me nothing.
Yeah.
It was literally getting me nothing, because at the end of that tunnel, there was no college. There was no scholarship. That wasn't on my menu. My dad ran a business, and my menu was, I'm going to go work for my dad. I'm a spoiled little shit. And yeah, that's all I thought. So I totally turned away from school because there were no incentives. When I started developing incentives was when I was 12 years old, my dad put me to work mopping the floors in the shop floor, and I actually got paid for it.
Right.
Or so he said. He just saved money on the side, which I cashed in years later. But nevertheless, that was the incentive, and that's what I put effort towards. That or things that I could become good at, and I started learning mastery of certain skills. How applicable they were, another story, but nevertheless, I completely turned away where you sort of you took control of it, and that's interesting. I never really thought of it that way.
Well, I mean, there's numerous factors to take into account with my experience. You know, I grew up in a town in rural Pennsylvania.
So did I.
That's in like coal country.
So was mine.
And if I had been an average student, I would have been stuck there.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not want to get stuck there. I knew that from a pretty young age. I did not want to be there. So I don't know if that's something that was conditioned into me or what.
Well, no, that's a pretty common mentality. I mean, when I was in school, I'm a few years older than you, but everyone's mentality was, I don't want to be in this town anymore. The only way out is to get a degree.
Right.
That's my doorway out of
right.
here.
And you know, I was talking with one of my colleagues with one of the organizations I work with that is a venture capital fund that primarily invests in companies started by dropouts. And, you know, he lives out in Indiana, and he's done a lot of work in the Midwest. And, you know, Western Pennsylvania is kind of the Midwest. Appalachia is its own, like, little place. And one of the reasons I like what they do in particular, and a lot of the organizations I try to work with, this is one of the things I liked about Praxis, is a lot of the Praxis participants come from, like, podunk towns in the middle of nowhere.
Right.
Otherwise, the only other way they would be able to get out would be by going to college.
Right. They're the ambitious ones.
I mean, they're the ones who... Yeah, they'll be able to, if you give them some sort of structure that they could work within, they'll go to it, right? Otherwise, people have to create the structure, and that's really hard. And that's the big part of deschooling to me is school does not train people to create their own structure, right?
Right.
There are two types of structure in this world. One is what I call imposed structure. This is the structure you find in school, in large bureaucratic corporations, in the military, right?
Which, as we've been talking about, is the kind that most people are conditioned
right.
at a very malleable
Absolutely.
Time in life
Absolutely.
To need and to crave.
Yeah. Absolutely. And if you're familiar with Peter Gray's work in particular, you know that people actually naturally aren't really programmed for that. But you put them through 12 years of our school system,
yeah.
and they'll become conditioned to want that. They'll become conditioned to want, well, what's the assignment? Or what do I get out of doing well in this test? Or will this be on the test, right?
Mm-hmm.
I work with a number of teachers all across the country, often in like private school classrooms, who they understand that the industrial school system is destroying the children that they're working with.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things they try to consistently do is get their students connect their education to the real world. And the question that comes back to them at the end of every single day is will this be on the test? Right.
Yeah.
And this is something when I meet grown adults, if they're learning something, if there is not some sort of test outside of it, they don't actually sit down to learn it.
Right. What's the reason to learn it if it's
right.
not, if,
right.
I, if I'm not
if,
tested?
If the incentive
it.
Is like, oh, you know, maybe someday in the future I'll be able to apply these concepts to my hypothetical business. Right.
Well, right. But who's going to explain how to create your own structure? So you explained earlier how you sort of you took a risk by jumping off and doing your own thing.
I mean, I had
professionally. That's a very big risk, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I can tell you, even like for someone who for years has been working kind of in this space education wise, and the whole reason I got interested in the concepts I wrote about in the end of school was these weird little nuances I would see when largely working with the Praxis participants is that some of the homeschooled participants were much more mature, much more capable, especially the unschooled ones, mm-hmm. much more capable of creating the structure for themselves than the students who came out of prestigious private schools or prestigious public schools.
So it's environments that either enforce the embrace of extrinsic motivation.
Yes.
You know,
it's all conditioning.
Down,
it's all conditioning.
Or ones that there's the fostering of intrinsic motivation. You know,
I don't even really like the extrinsic versus intrinsic motivation kind of framework because that often comes back to this concept of willpower. It's like, oh, well, do you have the willpower for this intrinsic motivation, or how do you develop intrinsic motivation? I almost think of it more in terms of, like I said, conditioning.
Yeah, there's no reason you can't use external sources to motivate yourself.
Absolutely. I mean, the attorney I was speaking to this morning even told me, he's like, yeah, Zach, and maybe this is part of his schooling, but I often don't feel the motivation. He's hated his job for years, and I think we were finally able to get a breakthrough with him to go and start pursuing new things outside of this job that he's in. He said, often I won't pursue things unless I get the actual, like, I need to burn the ships, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's no other option. I'm really under the gun. And you can use that for yourself. You don't have to invent all these crazy new systems or go and like meditate in the mountains and find your intrinsic motivation. You can use the conditioning that's out there in the world. You can use the systems that are out there in the world to push yourself.
So for years and years, when all my friends were off at college, you know, being paid for on their parents' dime for the most part, I was just floundering. I was just trying to figure out what the hell I should do to make some money and earn a living. And my goal was just to make as much money as possible. No more thought went into it than that.
Yeah.
And I bounced from job to job to job. I never put myself in a position where I couldn't just up and leave. And after a few years of that, I said, all right, this is getting crazy. You're moving every 6 months or a year. It's expensive. You're not amassing any kind of wealth. You have no plans for the future. Just get a job that pays well and stick with it. And I always excelled at every job. So I got this one job, and I started working my way up the ladder. At a certain point, I hit a ceiling financially. I couldn't earn any more money. There were no more positions to kind of climb to without offing my boss.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I struggled for years with, okay, I've invested this much time, this much effort, this much mental energy. This job is consuming my life, and it has given me money. For an uneducated guy, I'm doing pretty well. But my life was miserable. It was this job 7 days a week and nothing more. So at a certain point, I reached a breaking point where it was ruining my relationships. It completely eliminated any social life I may have had. And I finally said, all right, I got to just, you know, burn the ships. I got to burn these bridges. Now, I got recommendations. I didn't burn bridges with individuals in that company. But I had to just quit because I didn't even have time to look for a new job. And that everything, every fiber of my being, everything I trained myself to do for the previous 5 years at that job told me, do not leave this. This is stability. Yeah. This is what you should be doing. You have benefits. You have this, that, and the other. And I just had to give it all up because I had to find something else. And I took a pay cut initially, but it was the best decision I ever made. I had a job instantly almost, and it wasn't a problem at all.
No, I always tell people, especially if they're coming from a position where they've got a relatively safe job, but they hate it, or they're starting to tap out what they could get from a job, both learning-wise and earning-wise, it's better to act sooner rather than later, right?
Right, and I went on way too long, and that's my biggest regret. I don't regret leaving.
Oh, I can attest to having experiences like that in the past myself. One of my favorite stories is from Zero to One, Peter Thiel's book, about his time. And he's the co-founder of PayPal and one of the first outside investor in Facebook. And he went to law school, and then he went to this big law firm, and he clerked. He was applying to be a clerk on the Supreme Court, and he didn't get it. He did not get the position. Which, had he gotten that position, he probably would not have gone on to start PayPal. He probably would not have gone on to do everything that he has done, right? And he ran into a friend from Stanford Law a couple years later. The friend was like, well, I guess you're pretty glad you didn't get that clerkship, huh? Right?
Right.
So I think being able to put ourselves in these positions where it's you expect you're going to get X, Y, or Z, whether it's fulfillment from a job or a promotion or something along these lines. If you don't get it, there's always a useful reframe here. And I think one of the most useful reframes is, okay, what is the growth that could be in front of me because of this?
Right.
Like
absolutely.
The attorney I was speaking to this morning, he was falling into the sunk cost fallacy. I was not planning on having this conversation this morning, but it works really well for our conversation now. He keeps falling into the sunk cost fallacy where it's like, I went and I got my JD.
And how far in is he again?
He's, I don't know. He's probably 30.
Okay.
He's a relatively young guy. I went and I got my JD, and do I need to remain an attorney? I feel like I need to because I got the JD. And I told him, like, you know, that's called the sunk cost fallacy. You're not going to get that time back regardless. But that's not a useful reframe for people. You know, I'll run into people who will say, well, I want to finish college since I'm already 2 years in. It's like, well, if you leave now, it's not like you get those 2 years back, right?
Right.
And if you stay in, it's not like you get those 2 years back. Those 2 years are gone regardless. But that doesn't help people. The way of helping people is you tell them, okay, but let's say you get to somewhere where you're really, really fulfilled, you're earning more, you're happier, you're learning more. You wouldn't have gotten there had it not been for those 2 years that you spent in school. So they're not a waste.
No, you know, I rail on college on the show all the time.
I mean, I wouldn't be where I am had I not gone for 2 years to college.
No, and
right?
I went for four. And I went for six. In retrospect, they were all valuable.
And it's really important for us to clarify here that we're not saying we are where we are because of something that college caused, but the path of events that we were able to pursue included that.
Right. And a big part of it was being able to, you know, even though I haven't been a master of it in all domains of life, but living consciously through that experience and reflecting on that experience. Mm-hmm. And understanding, at least in a general sense, what the takeaways were that were valuable,
yeah.
You know, or how I felt going through certain things, you know, how I fell in love with history, how at 16 years old, I would have burned every history book in the school if I could have. And then after having this experience, I wanted to be a history teacher. There's 5 years in between those two mindsets. And I really had to focus and say, what happened there? What were the feelings? What were the experiences that I had that were so transformative? Mm-hmm. You know, I was fortunate to just be like thinking through that in a deliberate way. So,
well, getting back to what you were saying earlier about how these thoughts that have been schooled into you mm-hmm. still apply to you today and still kind of make their way into your daily thoughts. I have that too, you know, taking that leap and taking that different job, the unknown, you know, leaving whatever is stable and comfortable. It always seemed like the irresponsible decision. In retrospect, it was actually very responsible to not still be with that company. They're in a lawsuit.
But you can't see it from...
There's no way to see it. But so how do you get over that type of fear-based thought without swinging the whole other direction and going, oh, is it risky? Yeah, it's going to be great.
Well, there's a couple different reframes I think you can use. There's a couple different ways you can think about these things. One of those is, what is the way that will allow me to grow the most, right? And to leverage myself into the future. Is it going to be staying in this job, or is it going to be taking these risks and learning the skills I'm going to need to learn in order to succeed to get through these risks? At the same time, too, I think it's important for people to keep in mind, why are they refusing to leave a job, or why are they refusing to leave school? Mm-hmm. Don't think of it in terms of this opportunity needs to justify itself to me, but rather, you need to justify to yourself why you should stay with the status quo, right? Like, why would you stay with that established job? Or why would you stay in college? Or why would you stay in graduate school? Whatever those may be.
Comfort.
Yeah, or just complete utter fear of the unknown. A good friend of ours, he struggles with a job he doesn't like. He thinks he can do more. He wants to do more, but he never takes the steps to actually make it happen.
Yeah.
He thinks simply putting a resume in with a stack of other resumes is enough.
Yeah.
And it's never going to be.
Right.
He's never going to stand out. Sure, he has the degree, he has the credentials, but so does everybody else.
Right. And there's usually a mindset there that translates into action or inaction. You know, like, I went through the motions of submitting my resume or, you know, doing this thing that would help me at work. But if there's not follow through, if there's not conviction about
it. You just have to use reverse psychology on these decision makers. Like, what do they expect people to do? Well, they probably expect the average person to just put in their resume. They expect the average person to interview. They expect the average person to do X, Y, and Z. What do they not expect the average candidate to do? Because people ask me, how do I actually stand out? And it's like, well, you know, you can do X, Y, or Z. But instead, think about what is your competition doing? Who are they? And what can you do that they're not doing?
Mm-hmm.
And that's hard for people. By definition, that's hard. This is one of the reasons why I think having an outside force, whether it's, you know, a mentor or a coach or whatever you want to call it, walk with you through this process is helpful for a lot of people.
I agree, because a lot of times that other perspective is so much clearer than your internal perspective on your own situation.
I mean, I've got a client who is starting a data science consultancy, right? And he's actually coming right out of college and already has like 6 employees and company's growing pretty quickly. And for him, he'll call me and he'll walk me through a scenario that he's going through. Say it's a negotiation with a big client, like a $30,000 client. And I'll have him walk through it and I'll tell him like, okay, what do you think? What do you think they're thinking here, right? What are their incentives? For me, I always encourage people, don't study, if you want to understand how people make decisions, don't study psychology, study economics. Mm-hmm. Study and understand people's incentives, study and understand price structures, study and understand how people engage in purposeful behavior, right? Like very basic kind of like Misesian economic theory. And I'll just walk him through it and I'll have him explain what the incentive structure of the decision maker that he's talking to is. What is this guy trying to achieve in his job? What is this guy trying to avoid in his job? And what is he trying to achieve and avoid as a person too, right?
Right.
So if he's like a middle manager, well, one of the things he's trying to avoid is looking silly in front of the CEO. Mm-hmm. So he doesn't want to bring on any kind of contractor that might risk him looking silly. Right. Or if he's very busy, say at home, he also doesn't want to just stay later at the office. Little things like this. And I'll walk this client of mine through this. And very often I don't have to tell him you should do X. And if I'm doing that, I'm not doing my job right.
Because well, as you're discovering the answer, so are they.
Right. Right. I don't have like this answer sheet in front of me.
No,
that's like
they're
the right
just vocalizing the scenario to you to the point where it's explained and you can sort of, you know, delineate an answer.
Right.
But it forces them to sort of get to the same conclusion.
And one of the reasons why I bring this up is because so often, more often than not, we'll just get to the conclusion and there will be this short pause and he'll say, Zach, this is so obvious to me now.
Right.
Yep.
Thank you. Right.
Well, so getting back to the, you know, standing out in a stack of resumes kind of thing, I used to be a manager and I would hire and I'd constantly be looking for people to hire, and I always had a stack of resumes, and it was always just a task that I never wanted to deal with. I didn't want to go through those resumes and call these people and schedule interviews. But if any of those people, and it doesn't have to be complicated how to stand out, I think the simpler the better, if any of those people just showed up one day and caught me as I was walking to the parking lot and just said, hey, I'm so and so, I submitted a resume, I'll go, oh yeah, I think I saw your name, can I have 5 minutes of your time? I would absolutely give that person 5 minutes of my time. Worst case scenario for them, I've had a shitty day and they're going to get the bad end of it, but they're not any worse off than they were.
And I'm sure in your job doing sales, you've done cold visiting before in order to stand out as a salesman.
Absolutely.
I can tell you one of the best things I did when I was doing business development with the Praxis team was I would sometimes just cold visit businesses. Mm-hmm. I'd look them up, make sure they were some of the fastest growing companies in whatever city I was in, look at their job positions, see if they're hiring something we could help with, and just show up at like 8:50 in the morning and see if I can catch the president or the CEO walking in. Same thing if you want to stick out. Like, send you a nice actual email that the person actually wrote saying why they applied for the job, what they can do for you, how they can create more value, or show up at the office or anything more than just here's my resume.
Yeah, absolutely.
What so many people do when they go look for a new job is the first thing they do is they redraft their resume.
It's resume first.
And then they go shoot it into jobs. And it's no, you need to find the job first and then tailor your resume
absolutely.
To
right.
it.
It's absolutely. Like they're walking around with the resume taped to their face to a company and they go, oh, you got a resume? Thanks. See ya.
Right.
And if you have end of interaction.
A specific skill set, you know, this isn't too much work. You know? Like I've done this. It's just tooling and whittling away different things and adding, you know, other things that are on the rec. But yeah, I mean, people have kind of a fixed resume. I remember at one point in my career, I lost the Word version, so all I had was the PDF.
Oh,
I was just
there.
Being lazy about rebuilding it from a Word document.
And I think this all comes back to this broader concept of de-schooling is you need to know more often than not what it is you're trying to go for before you actually engage in some of these actions.
Okay.
Otherwise, you end up getting stuck in like this endless parade of utility maximizing of some kind, like you were saying about with your career, job after job after job, but you weren't really pursuing anything particularly helpful or meaningful.
Well, I certainly had no career,
right?
But I also had nothing fulfilling,
right? Absolutely.
So I took us way off the tracks a while back, which is fine, and I expect that to happen.
I mean, I can literally talk for days about the problems between colleges and careers, and high school and school and careers.
So you were explaining these two frames of...
organic versus organic structure. Yeah.
Right. So one being more top-down, and that was as far as I think we got before I injected the intrinsic versus extrinsic motivation. So,
yeah, and I just... I find that the intrinsic versus extrinsic conversation gets bogged down very quickly, so I kind of sidestep it all together.
Sure.
say. Let's think in terms of rather conditioning. Right?
I like that. That's a new way of framing it.
I like to think in terms of systems as well. Systems exist independent of me. I just need to set them up. And the term I will use often is machine. So like I'll teach people what I call set up an inbound machine for your business so that people keep coming to your business, or an outbound machine so that you can easily do introductions, get introductions to people, do cold emails. There's a concept in my new book that is called the opportunity machine. The reason I like machines is you build a machine, you start it, you maintain it every couple of certain time periods.
Absolutely.
And it runs.
Right.
Right. It runs independent of you. And that's the same thing I like to think about in terms of structure. You want to be able to get some sort of organic structure in your life. And organic structure is simply, I want to achieve a certain outcome of some kind. And we may not even know what exactly that outcome is. Which that's often the biggest question that people have when it comes to goal setting. I hate the self-helpy stuff around goal setting, where there will be all these ridiculous goal setting workshops that self-help gurus will run for people. And more often than not, my issue was, even though I always did very, very well at school, I think because I was very highly schooled by the time I was, you know, 18 years old, mm-hmm. is I didn't know what my goals were. So it's like...
You always had a roadmap in front of you.
Yeah, which was school, which was, you know, get good grades, get to the next level, get to set the major, graduate from college, go to graduate school, do all these things.
All your milestones were laid out.
It's hardly even a map. It's more like tracks.
Yeah, no, a track that someone gave me.
Yeah,
and in my case, specifically, the path I was on or was set to be on was a path given to me by the Institute for Humane Studies in order to become a philosophy professor,
right.
which is great. And they're a great organization. And that was incredibly helpful if that was the path I wanted to pursue. But I'd come back to all these self-helpy like goal-setting workshops, and more often than not, I'd run into people who they didn't know what their goals actually were. So how can you set an effective goal if you don't know what it should be?
Let's solve that problem.
Okay.
Okay, to be continued, but before we wrap up, I'm going to leave you with a two-minute preview of what's coming in the next installment. Thanks again, everybody. Here you go.
Let's go back to the key phrase that operates... as background for everything I'm talking about here, fulfillment does not come from achievement. It comes from progress towards the achievement of meaningful goals.
Absolutely.
Okay, so how do we get to the point? There's a lot of words we need to define there, but how do we get to the point of meaningful goals, right? And then how do we get to progress towards, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing we need to do is we need to remove all the ones that aren't meaningful. All the ones that are going to chew away at us every single day. So there's this concept. I was originally introduced to it by Nassim Taleb in his book Anti-Fragile, but you can dig into it in like Thomist philosophy that largely comes from the philosopher St. Thomas Aquinas that's called via negativa.
Mm-hmm.
So that means like through the negative. And what Aquinas was trying to figure out was how do we define God, or how do we define the divine, or how do we define holy? And instead of asking, you know, what are and debating all these characteristics of God, right? We can ask, well, what is God not? What is the holy not?
Mm-hmm.
What is the divine not? And then we work through a process of elimination. So you can imagine by removing all these characteristics that you don't want, you get a silhouette of something, right? And that silhouette is better than having nothing there, right? And then you can fill in the details of the silhouette. I also like to think of it, there is a reason I call it ambition mapping. If you're going somewhere, you don't just drive in that direction. You know, if you're driving to San Francisco, you don't just start driving west. You figure out what the address is that you're going to in San Francisco, and then you work backwards, and you eliminate all the other places you don't want to drive to as a function of driving to San Francisco, right?
Okay.
But via negativa is figuring out what are the things that day in and day out you don't want to build for your career, right? And we use the sentence completion exercises to figure that out.